From awaytogarden.com and robinhoodradio.com, this is Away to Garden with Margaret Roach, your weekly invitation to dig in and grow.
Though many of you may share my disbelief at the fact that it's already well into November, that hasn't slowed the pace of your urgent garden questions on Facebook and in the comments on awaytogarden.com. No matter the month, we gardeners apparently still have plants on our minds. Here to help answer, as he does each month, is my friend and longtime garden writer and photographer, Ken Drews of kendrews.com, author of The New Shade Garden and Making More Plants, and many other favorite garden books. Hello, Ken.
Hi, Margaret.
So we're at mid-November. How much frost have you had in what zone are you again? Are you a 7 or a 6B?
6A.
6A.
Today was the first frost.
Really? And so today we should tell people we're taping on, is it the 9th today of November?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes, it is.
Yeah, and I had one 10 days ago, and now I've had three since, and I'm having tomorrow night, the 10th of November, is forecast for 14 degrees Fahrenheit. Oh, okay. Okay. Anyway, yeah. So sort of the extra warm fall, I don't know about you, but it sort of had me, it was like summery and it had me complacent. So
it's
I guess, so confusing. Yeah. So I'll kind of be out there now this next week in my long johns and woolies and mittens, right, doing the cleanup. We'll tell people housekeeping detail first. If they're listening to this show, there's a full transcript with helpful links added in it at awaytogarden.com. So if you have you hear something we're talking about and you want a little more info, look for the transcript. And also, if you have a question for a later show, you can post it in comments on the website or on Ken's website at kendrews.com, our contact forms to email us, or at facebook.com/awaytogarden. So, shall we dive right into the thick of it and resolve?
Sure.
Yeah.
What you got?
Why don't we resolve what's both a garden issue and a marital dispute? How do you feel about that?
Again?
Again, we have another marital dispute.
You know what I say? You can't have a democracy with two people.
There you go. And you know what? One of the haha horticulture jokes is about marital gardening with your spouse. They say you need separate beds.
Absolutely.
Yeah, absolutely. So
Anne, problem with that is you can't compromise with two people either.
So Anne on Facebook she wrote in to say, my husband and I keep arguing. I say I want to use an organic lawn fertilizer. He says any nitrogen source is fine. She's a bit about making a safe place for birds and bees and bugs and whatnot. She doesn't want to use petroleum-based fertilizers. She says those are a no-go. She wants to know what we think. This is an easy one. No trick question here for us, right, Ken?
So that's for fall?
Well, I think she wants to know at any time, but he's, I think they're a little farther south and they're doing a fall lawn feed.
Okay. I've never fertilized my lawn.
And I think I do it like once every 5 years at the most. Yeah.
I do top dress with compost, especially, you know, we both have garden tours from time to time.
Yes.
And if there's a place that's kind of worn away or gotten trodden, I'll sprinkle like a half inch of compost on it. But that's all I do. Do you think that, you know, I hear fall feeding is the best thing and I hear fall feeding isn't necessary. What's your take on that?
I am sort of like a why fertilize the lawn unless what you just said, which is it looking weak? Is there a problem? Like if it's growing good and strong and I'm having to mow as I did every week this year, I had to mow twice a week, like every 3 or 4 days. I don't think it needs any nitrogen to help it grow more. You know what
no,
I mean? I mean, whoa.
Then you'd have to mow even more.
Exactly. So why make for more mowing, I think? If the lawn is looking weak and thin and whatever, I think you're right, the compost, maybe you use some supplemental fertilizer. I would use an all-natural organic fertilizer, however, and, you know, overseed, you know, scratch around and overseed and so forth. But I'm more of a, like, let my clippings lie on the lawn. You know, when I mow, I don't cut off too much and I let the clippings lie, which kind of feeds the lawn, quote-unquote. And, you know, I even sort of mulching mower, use the mulching mower on a light covering of leaves and crumble those up into the lawn.
Absolutely.
Yeah, so it's sort of like I'm sort of feeding the lawn the way nature does, do you think? I mean, it sounds like we both do that.
Yeah, except that nature doesn't trim itself to 2 inches.
No. No, but I mean, it decomposing stuff is the only fertilizer that nature provides, right?
And, you know, also as you're saying this, I'm thinking about runoff. If there's too much nitrogen or if there's a heavy rain after you put something down, especially a chemical,
right,
then that's going to – there's so many problems with runoff and waterways and – everything. Yeah. I'm with you. Let's leave it be.
So I think we can tell Anne, I mean, both of us are organic gardeners. I don't want to, even if there was some kind of belief that it was equally safe or what, which it isn't, I don't think it is. I don't want to give my money to the cause of, you know, kind of upstream pollution. You know, I don't want to give my dollars to that kind of company and that kind of industry necessarily. So I'd rather use, as you said, compost. If I really needed fertilizer, I want it to be from an all-natural organic source, the byproduct, the waste material of some other industry, you know, that type of thing. So, okay, so Anne, we are voting with you. Marital dispute resolved. So Lauren wrote in an email to me, she said, and she's in Zone 5B, similar to where I am in New York State. She said, when it's a sort of a when is too late question. She said at the beginning of November, is it too late to move perennials around in her beds? She still needs to rearrange a few things. And as you and I just spoke about, it had been kind of warm and a little deceptive. What's your sort of like, I mean, I suspect you, as I have been caught with a bag of bulbs that hasn't been planted and you've been using a pickaxe to get through the
No.
frozen soil. No.
Oh my gosh, that's what I did all weekend last week.
but I mean, when the soil's already frozen, like some December or something,
you
forget that you have this bag of bulbs or
they
something.
They come up.
Yeah, I know they do. But so for moving perennials around, what would your normal sort of cutoff date? How would you figure that out relative to like final frost?
Well, when it's too cold for you as a human, I would say. Uh-huh. I think a lot of things could be moved, and they're fine, but the issue with moving plants too late maybe might be, for me, it's frost heaves.
Exactly.
So if I move something, I want to be sure to mulch it with a light mulch like pine branches, something mm-hmm. to shade the ground just so it doesn't freeze and thaw and freeze and thaw if we don't have a nice snow cover. Because that can push a newly planted perennial right out of the ground. But if it's a hardy perennial and it's dormant, I think you can move it. I wouldn't divide a whole lot of stuff right now.
Right, into
and
tiny
certainly
pieces,
if you have
right.
a deciduous tree, now is a perfect time to plant.
Right, and I think it, as practically as long as the ground can be worked, we move woody
right.
things, most woody things. And I'm with you, and certain perennials, I mean, for instance, if I were you know, heucheras, for instance, they don't have much of a big root system. And, you know, I'd be a little hesitant to, you know what I mean? They're going to come flying out of the ground. They do that some years anyway, even an older plant. Whereas something with a big dense, you know, a big piece of something that's going to keep itself in the ground a little better. But normally I finish with her moving herbaceous things. Normally I have frost in early October. This year it was Halloween night. So November, it was, the first night between the end of October and beginning of November. And so that was kind of late. But normally I finish moving herbaceous things around October 15th, you know, so I will have had some light frost typically, but not freezes in the ground.
Right.
Yeah.
Right.
So that would be, you know, I told Lauren when she asked, you know, she was right at the edge of it. It sounds like you and I agree on that too. So I wanted to say to everybody, there are a lot of questions, two questions actually have come up multiple times this month. I mean, like 3, 4, 5, 6 times. A lot of people have been asking about crazy worms, you know, those Asian jumping. I know, there you go. After our discussion a couple of months ago on the show. And we're not going to tackle that again today, I know, but I want everyone to know that you and I are both very, very alarmed/concerned about this subject. And it's my most urgent garden question and probably yours too. I mean, I don't know what to do as I see the advance of these soil-destroying worms. I'm trying to get the right experts on the show in subsequent months to come talk about it. So, you know, with some authority, some people who are researching it. So I just wanted to tell all the people who shared their urgent garden questions about that, that that's something we'll get to again.
Yep.
Yeah.
I lectured in New Haven this week, and that was one of the questions.
Yes.
So, and people are surprised and horrified.
Yes. Yes.
What do you think about going into the mole business? You know, like breeding moles to share? Maybe another get-rich-slow scheme?
There you go. You're just full of those, you know.
A million of them. I got a million.
Okay. The other most popular question over and over and over again this early November, and from people in all different zones, apparently a lot of people's vegetable gardens got away from them this year. So here's the sampling. See if you detect a common thread here. Anne Marie on Facebook says, what's the best way to restart an overgrown vegetable garden? I let mine grow this summer and now have 6-foot weeds to deal with, and it's a very large garden. And like 2 seconds later on Facebook, Julie chimed in, me too, it's overwhelming. And Hani said on Facebook also, you know, I have 2 little kids and have not had time to clean up my vegetable garden. Yes, Margaret, there are rotting tomatoes still out there, she confessed. She says she knows that she's already committed sort of a big no-no by not cleaning up, but how to minimize potential disease due to her neglect and so on. And I mean, really, there were many of them. So what do you think about vegetable garden cleanup? And I guess we should say best practices and what to do with these overgrown disasters. I don't know where you want to start.
Wow. Well, you are the expert, of course.
Oh, sure.
But I would generally say to rake up the juicy parts, like tomatoes and things,
yes,
and cart them off to the compost. I think if it's like vines or remnants of vines, you can just leave them. I don't think that's a big deal, and it's kind of a mulch in a way, and maybe it'll provide cover for some animals or something. I don't think it's a big deal if you didn't have disease, for example.
Right.
You know, if you were in good shape. But you started off by saying the weeds got away from me, so that's kind of a different thing.
I agree. It's not right. It's not just some faded green bean plant, bush bean plant, or something. It's
right.
Weeds, which means what? It means probably seeds are setting or have been set and are going to distribute, and I'm going to have 50 more weeds. So what do we do? let's talk about the worst case scenario where it's overgrown. I mean, what are the ways that that can be tackled? 6-foot weeds or however many feet tall. You can cut them all down.
Yeah, cut them all down. And, you know, we always, when we start a garden or start a bed or want to kill the lawn or things like that, it's a version of solarizing, I guess. That's not really what it is, but
right.
I used to
smothering.
Put down
right.
Layers of cardboard. Now with Amazon and everything, you get cardboard boxes, so many you can't get rid of them. And
right.
Just take off the tape and take out the staples and lay the cardboard flat on the ground in one layer, and then cover that with, first moisten it completely.
Yes.
And then cover it with either a mulch or even better, a couple inches of your beautiful, wonderful, seed-free compost.
Right.
And if you need to, you can just dig, you can punch a hole in that and plant right away, or better, let it go through the winter and then turn it over, turn it under in the spring, if that's what you do.
So one thing that Anne Marie or Hani could do would be cut the stuff down, but then smother the remaining roots of the plant, the stems and roots of the plant, with a cardboard that we then moisten and then a mulch on top, some kind of material
right.
like a mulch on top.
Or four layers of newspaper, I do that too.
Right.
And you have to really cover it completely, even the corners.
Right.
Because if you don't, it sucks the moisture out of the cardboard and it won't decompose. Because over the winter, that cardboard, it'll be gone in the spring pretty much.
Yeah. So there's that. And I have to say, even if it's a big garden, like I went out a couple weeks ago and I cleaned out all my vegetable beds. And I had been looking at it and looking at it and looking at it and thinking, oh, God, oh, God, oh, God. You know, that kind of – because it looks like a big deal, because vegetable plants, by their nature, a lot of the things we grow, like squash vines and
– gourds.
Gourds, exactly, and pole beans. And, you know, it's like 10 feet tall and 10 feet long and whatever. And it looks like a lot. But when you go to pull up a squash vine, it literally – you know, you get the whole thing in one, you know, you have your wheelbarrow, your tarp, better yet a tarp. I just kind of went through like, you know, 20 miles, 50 miles an hour or whatever, bing, 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 throwing it all onto a tarp and just drag the tarp over to the heap. It really becomes quicker than you think. I think because you're not trying to edit around all your precious perennials in a bed where some weed has infested and you're picking one weed at a time. It's like a wholesale eradication of either spent plants or weeds, right? So I would, if one can stomach it, if one can muster the strength, I'd pull them out by the roots and then put that weed suppressing stuff, that layer down, because I bet there's a lot of seeds that are going to come up next year.
Yeah, I don't know how much you're going to really kill in the soil as far as weed seeds, but you're certainly going to suppress quite a few.
Right. Give them dark, you know, the plants that I would be careful, I mean, Hani asks about, you know, minimizing potential disease due to her neglect and, but I the ones that I'm careful with are where, depending on where you live, in the Northeast, one of the problems we have, there are certain kinds of pests frequent in vegetable gardens that do overwinter, and they love to be sort of near the source of their favorite food. So some of our squash pests, some of our squash bugs, and also some of our brassica pests, you know, the broccoli and cauliflower and all that kind of stuff, some of those. So I like to be scrupulous with those two kinds of crops and remove all that debris to a distance, you know, as far away as I can, so that it's not just sitting there sort of waiting for those critters to have a field day and wake up early in the spring and say, oh, look, there's delicious food here for us. So I target certain things that I make sure I do carefully. And like you said, all the squishy, wet stuff and whatever.
Do you rotate tomatoes and things like that for wilt?
In a small, you know, relatively small, I have, you know, I don't know how many raised beds, you know, 15 raised beds or something like that. It's really hard to do that. It's really, really hard to do that. So I do a certain amount of rotation. I don't literally plant the tomatoes every year in the same place in the same bed, or the onions or garlic every year in the same bed. But I can't do like a 3-year rotation. And you know what I mean? I don't have enough beds for that. So, yeah. So I think that's what we would recommend to them is do the best they can this year. Maybe do some smothering as well. One of the questions that came up that surprised me, because we haven't had it before, but it's something that reminded me of you, Ken, was about sort of urban gardening. It was from Marissa on Facebook, and she says she is making a balcony garden in Manhattan, so like a terrace. And she'd love to grow some food, and she'd love to attract some birds. And so it's not a whole roof. I think one of your first gardens or your first garden was a rooftop.
Yeah.
Where was it?
In Manhattan, in Soho, in New York. It was one of my first gardens, an early garden, on an 8,000 square foot, 80 by 100 foot roof. But I didn't garden on the whole thing. And I gardened in containers. And it's kind of hard. You don't have the problem with soil diseases because you don't have any soil.
Right.
Or you shouldn't, anyway. That's a big topic, but as far as growing food on a rooftop, providing this person has gotten approval from the landlord and checked her insurance, and if she knows
important.
Where the roof drain is, what?
Well, and hers is a terrace, so, or a balcony. So it's super important. Step one, find out the rules from your building and make sure you're following their guidelines, right?
Right, the weight and everything.
Right.
And then you'd want to know about the sun and the shade and the wind. And I started to say about the roof drain, because you have to have drainage. And you don't want to put the containers directly on the surface of the balcony, because you might damage it, or, you know, things will get all gross. So I when I had my containers, I elevated them on bricks, or you can even get 2x4s and just make a grid and put your containers. You want to have air circulation under them, and you want the water to run under them. And, you know, like pot feet.
Right.
And you have to have a moisture source, a source for water, because you can't be schlepping it out there every day. And in August, you do have to water sometimes every day. I know I'm making this person think it's not worth it.
Well, speaking of that, I mean, I would really recommend that anyone who's going to do container gardening, especially in like an exposed place like a terrace or a rooftop in an urban setting with lots of concrete and heat and whatever, fewer, larger containers, maybe not super heavy, so they're a million tons, but do you know what I mean? Not like 8-inch pots that are going to have to be watered every 12 minutes in the summer.
Oh,
right?
Absolutely.
Right.
But a lot of things do really well. If you have the sun and if you have a little protection from wind, you can grow tomatoes. I would certainly say grow some of those determinate dwarfy tomatoes.
Yes.
And I always started peas in March on my rooftop in Soho. And I had, you know, snap peas. And if I didn't harvest fast enough, I gave them to the dog who loved them. I had some very good luck with raspberries.
Oh, that's
about
funny.
One of the best things, just cane fruits. I had the ever-bearing kind, like all gold.
Yes.
Those. And I tried everything. But some hardy things will go away and come back, and then you can do some temporary things too, some annuals.
Herbs would be good, I would think, on a balcony because it's something that's expensive to buy, yet you can really spice up your cooking literally with it, you know, as opposed to just paying – you know, $2.50 or $3 for a bunch of this and then $3 for a bunch of that, you can have this, you know, like a big container with multiple herbs to cut from. That would be a good one. It'd be beautiful.
I guess in a way it depends on the herb, of course, but because if you want to grow basil in a pot or in a container for pesto, you'd be surprised how fast you run out of it. And it all happens at once, you know. You think that you're going to you can snip rosemary, but that's not necessarily going to come back. You know, you just need a little bit. But with basil, you harvest it, and it has to be harvested before it blooms. And there you have all your basil's kind of gone, and it took up a lot of space. So I don't know. Maybe the herbs have to be planted in among some other things just so.
Well, around the tomato, for instance, if you had a tub with a tomato in it, you could have you could have the what do they call the small leaf, the little bush basil that's the fine leaf. What is it called? It's sort of a mini basil. Anyway, it's almost looks like a topiary. You know, it stays small. You could put that around its feet, around the tomato's feet, or you could have parsley hanging over the edge of that whole tub, and that would be great. You know, there's some classes. She's in Manhattan, and this is at the New York Botanical Garden in the Bronx, but Annie Novak, who wrote that great book about rooftop growing not long ago, she teaches, I think, there. I think she works there. I think she teaches there. So at nybg.org, Marissa could find out about some of her classes. And again, she's more like rooftop and urban farming, but the principles that you're talking about evaluating your site, the wind conditions, the light, the weight bearing, the drainage, not having stuff directly on the ground, you know, on the surface, elevating. That's the same principles, right?
Yes, that sounds like a really good idea. I mean, you do learn by doing, but this could be quite a process. So you might as well cut off the first 5 years by taking a course.
Yeah, and of course there are places in New York City and elsewhere that specialize in this type of gardening. And, you know, you could you know, do a web search to find out some of those. But if you're going to DIY, I think the first step is definitely you've got to find out from your building what's permitted, the size of the pots that are permitted, et cetera, et cetera. I mean, that's really important.
And don't grow things that nobody wants. You know, if your family won't eat okra, don't grow okra. And I know people grow corn in containers, but corn's wind pollinated and, you know, or don't buy something that's incredibly readily available right down on the ground.
Right,
at
zucchini.
The
right,
grocers.
Right. No, I think you're right. So, well, we've managed to squander an entire program
usual.
Of course, and bore everyone to tears. No, not actually. Hopefully. These were their questions. We tried to answer their questions. As I said, we'll have more links and details for more information about some of these subjects in the transcript on awaytogarden.com. So, Ken, are you going to go out and do more cleanup?
It's always just a pleasure to speak with you. What were you going to say?
Go do some cleanup.
Next frost.
Exactly. Go do some cleanup. And then get in your car and drive up and help me. I'll make hot cocoa.
Do you have oak leaves? I'll do it for oak leaves.
Okay. He will work for oak leaves. That's Ken Drews.
I work for oak leaves.
I'll talk to you soon. Thank
you. Preferably shredded.
Okay. I'll talk to you soon. Thanks.
Good.
And thanks to all of you for listening, and I hope I'll talk to you again soon, too. Now, don't miss an episode. You can subscribe free to the podcast version on Stitcher or iTunes. Find me anytime at awaytogarden.com or at facebook.com/awaytogarden. Find Ken at kendrews.com. And happy gardening meantime.
A Way to Garden with Margaret Roach is a joint production of awaytogarden.com and the smallest NPR station in the nation, Robin Hood Radio.